This is the Future Great City Podcast from NextSTL.com. Today, we speak with Megan Green, Alderwoman of the 15th Ward in the city of St. Louis. Originally from upstate New York, Megan attended Penn State University before earning a Master's in Education and Leadership from St. Louis University. She was elected to the 28-member Board of Aldermen in 2014 and will be up for re-election in March 2017. A self-described progressive, Megan has become known for her independence on citywide issues and her thorough independent research on topics such as the effort to keep the NFL in St. Louis. She's dedicated to increasing transparency in local government and is involved in national politics as an organizer for presidential candidate Bernie Sanders. Today we're joined by Megan Green, the Alderwoman for the 15th Ward of the great city of St. Louis. Welcome, Megan.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for coming in. We're sitting in the 17th Ward. Does it feel uncomfortable? Did you have to get permission to visit or anything?
You know, occasionally I'll come up here to go out to eat or something like mm-hmm. that, and I'll actually run into a resident from the 15th Ward, and they'll give
weird?
Me a little bit of grief for venturing outside the ward to dare to
like,
eat somewhere else.
Like they're here too, right?
Right,
so it's
right.
like it's like shopping at Walmart, and you're like kind of, and then you see someone you know, and you're like,
Just don't tell anyone.
Right, like you're both busted, but it's awkward. Anyway, I don't know if that's the best analogy. So we're here at Space Architects, is where we record the podcast in the 17th Ward. Tell us where the 15th Ward is. It's not too far away.
No, it's basically south of Tower Grove Park. So mm-hmm. Tower Grove Heights, Tower Grove South, and a little bit of Tower Grove East.
And so, and I've been looking at those wards. We've had Sean Spencer in on the podcast and talking about the neighborhoods around Tower Grove Park. And it's a fascinating part of the city because in one way, it's probably as beautiful and as expensive as it's ever been. I mean, you have homes selling for I don't know, $400,000 and $500,000 or more.
Definitely.
You have a lot of investment happening. You have a lot of money and individuals with income coming into the neighborhood. You have great restaurants. The Tower Grove Park is beautiful. On the other hand, you're losing population pretty fast over the last decade, and
right.
that those things don't mentally kind of coincide for a lot of people. So what's happening in the 15th Ward?
Well, you know, there's a number of things happening. We're seeing a lot of buildings that were previously apartment buildings or two-family buildings that are being converted to one-families.
Mm-hmm.
We see four families that are being converted into townhouses. And, you know, one of the really important things about the work that the Community Development Corporation does is ensuring that we are keeping affordable housing in the neighborhood, that, you know, mm-hmm. we're not pricing out all of our diversity, pricing out all of our renters. We want to make sure that we
right.
keep that mixed income housing stock.
So what does that mean? Because this is a conversation that's kind of taking off in St. Louis as certain neighborhoods or certain wards are kind of, quote, getting hot, and you're seeing lots of development, and you see rents and home prices that to a lot of longtime residents just kind of don't make sense, you know, and they start to feel things are changing. So what does that mean to what does it mean to provide low-income housing to you? What's the metric? Like, how do you say, do we preserve X amount for low-income? Do we hold rent at a certain level? What do we do? How do we address that?
I mean, I've worked closely with our Community Development Corporation, and what we tend to do is set aside a certain number of units, mm-hmm. at least in the developments that they do, that say, you know, half is low-income housing, half is moderate income housing. It may differ between each development. Mm-hmm. But I think it's a larger problem than just a ward-based issue. I mean, you look
right.
at some other cities, and what they're starting to do is kind of community benefit agreements, things like that, that say, you know, a part of every development needs to be setting aside affordable housing and setting different quotas for different areas of the city, because mm-hmm. it's what we've learned, if we've learned anything from the history in St. Louis, you know, concentrations of poverty and wealth do not make for good mm-hmm. long-term sustainability for a city. And so, you know, we have to be consciously working to integrate our housing stock.
Mm-hmm. So it's fascinating to me because I think that I try to write about urbanism and city issues a lot, and you end up using definitions from kind of stereotypical cities. And so I think a lot of times when we talk about gentrification here or changing neighborhoods, people are using definitions you read about in the New York Times, or you read about these buildings where, like, you know, the high income people enter on one side of the building and low income enter on the other, and you're kind of like, we'll never do that in St. Louis.
Right.
Like, we're gonna fight the fight, but it strikes me as the issue being is very different here. And so it seems to me that the if you had to rank problems, and this is a terrible way to do it, but the number one problem would be a lack of investment, not right. investment forcing people out. Would you say we think that's accurate, or how do we make it St. Louis specific? And
I mean, I think it's not even a lack of investment. I think it's a lack of investment throughout the city. So we seem mm-hmm. to concentrate our investments, whether it's in the Central Corridor or, you know, in parts of Tower Grove South, and we're not taking a citywide or holistic right. view for creating investment and creating development across the entire city, even in areas that have been predominantly low mm-hmm. income.
And so whose responsibility is that in a city like St. Louis, where you have 28 wards and a basically weak mayor system, and who's going to do that?
I mean, it's a combination. It's a group effort between if there is a community development corporation in that area, and not every mm-hmm. ward has one, with St. Louis Development Corporation, with the alderperson, with if they have community organizations, those community organizations and the types of development that they want and will support in those areas. So there's really, you know, no one size fits all approach. And
sure.
and sometimes that's, I think, the challenge for St. Louis. We don't have some kind of comprehensive citywide plan on, you know, this is where mm-hmm. we're focusing our investment, and these are the tools that we're going to use. And, you know, we want to make sure that we are equally supporting investment in all 28 wards. We don't really have that. We have a very, you know, as much as we talk right. about the fragmentation of the county, we are equally as fragmented within the city mm-hmm. with all of these wards and having different policies and different procedures mm-hmm. and ways of implementing, you know, development or abatements or whatever
right.
in each one of those
right.
wards.
And I probably overstate the power of aldermen sometimes, but in terms of tax abatement and things like that, they weigh in pretty heavily. And it gets to the point where there's not a single person who's responsible for the vision of the city, or a single body even. So
right.
as a resident, you're voting for, you know, 2/29 technically, but 1/28 of the Board of Aldermen. So if you're
exactly.
if you're a resident and you have a vision for your city, there's no way to express that as a voter,
right.
which is really frustrating.
And it's frustrating as an alderman, too, because development doesn't start and stop at ward boundaries, which are, you know, often.
Tell us more about this.
You know.
But let me ask you a question that's on before I forget. Can you talk about any one or two or whatever developments in your ward that are what's happening now, like things that are things that you're proud of, or things that are working well, or things that are coming?
So probably the most exciting thing right now that's happening is Missouri Botanical Garden. Purchased some land from Guaranteed Electric Company, which has mm-hmm. long kind of been industrial. And
that's on Morgan Ford, sort of?
In Bent.
Yeah.
It's a very industrial area right now, but mm-hmm. it'll be coming their greenhouses. And
yeah.
And that's a very exciting investment that's happening right now. Mm-hmm. The other investments that are taking place are really regards to kind of safe streets and walkability, bikeability.
Mm-hmm.
Tower Grove Park and the CDC and the aldermen on the ward surrounding the parks, we got together and put out a TAP grant that was mm-hmm. funded to improve pedestrian access to the park. One of the chief complaints I get is about,
yeah.
you know, people not stopping at stop sign. It's not safe to get into the park, especially for, you know, people with kids or dogs. And
mm-hmm.
And that's
something that's stuck. Like Tower Grove Park does a great job inside the park, but
right.
their responsibility kind of ends at the curb. And then
exactly.
St. Louis City streets kind of take care of the streets, and then the wards are in the mix and trying to direct development, right?
Right. So it'll be a $1 million investment basically mm-hmm. around the park and through Center Cross that will help with that pedestrian access and make it a lot, you know, safer environment.
So you're talking about new crosswalks or bump outs or something. Is it Kings Highway and Magnolia and Arsenal and Grand, or where
yes.
are we going to see changes?
Mostly right now, we do already have a hawk signal or one of the signals where you can press and the
you know
the light changes.
The pejorative term is a beg button. You know,
where
pedestrians have to beg to cross the street.
Yes.
You know, it's not assumed that you're allowed to cross. You have to say, please, can I go?
We have one on Grand right now, but we really need one on Kings Highway
yeah.
as well. And we're looking at the rapid flashing beacon, you know, stop signs for along Arsenal, because one of the problems we have is, you know, we have stop signs and people just
yeah.
roll through them, and
yeah.
you know
yeah.
you're a mom standing there.
I think I've done
with,
that on my bike, but
yes.
I'm pretty good at avoiding strollers. So.
But at a, you know, with a car and a person with a dog and a stroller trying to cross the street and nobody will let them go.
It's... Yeah, I mean, so if you go back just in recent history, Arsenal was four lanes of traffic and parking, and so it's been reduced to two lanes of traffic and I think a turn lane on most of it maybe, and then bike lanes. And I remember reading like one of the – I don't think it was a joke. It was one of the complaints voiced on Twitter was I used to – you know, something – or no, the turn lane's gone in some places. I used to use the turn lane to pass people. Now you took it away from me. It's like – yeah.
I mean,
like,
we did,
and you can't do that anymore.
I mean, I've had that. The other complaint I get is it's – you know, it's caused – it now takes me 3 minutes more to get to work because of the traffic – back up
the havoc you wreak,
and you know, and so there is,
it takes me 3 minutes longer to pass through your ward, Megan. Yeah, and I won't vote for you if I have to pass through your ward.
So, it's always a balance, and you know, and you're never going to make 100% of the people happy. It's just not possible.
Well, so and these next two things kind of go together in a way. There's a 15th ward traffic study now that you've done that I've dug into a little bit, and hopefully I'll write about maybe by the time this posts. But I think it's crazy, A, you have to do a traffic study ward by ward, right? And it's crazy that I think things have to come out of the ward level to address this, and the city isn't proactively saying, how can we help our city? And then to go along with that, maybe we can talk about at the same time, is you're one of the older people that have a vision for the bigger city, and that has not always made your colleagues like you. Is that maybe fair to say? I mean, I feel like
it's probably fair.
It's, you know, there's aldermanic courtesy, which I guess is the concept of like, let me do whatever I want in my ward and I'll vote for whatever you want to do in your ward. But then there are things that come up that you can't avoid. So the 18th ward is probably fine with you doing your own traffic study in the 15th ward. Who cares? Which maybe there should be more of a bigger vision of it. But then there are big issues that come up like the NFL and the arch grounds and transit taxes, all kinds of things that really maybe only exist in one ward physically, but impact all of us. So maybe first talk about how that 15th ward traffic study came to be and why you're doing it on the ward level and what happens with that next.
So when I first got into office, I, you know, right away, the complaints that I started to get more than anything else had to do with traffic. Either wanting bike lanes, not wanting bike lanes, we can't cross the street.
More stop signs, fewer stop signs.
Right. Yeah. Direction of one ways. And everything.
So this is the job of an alder person a lot of times, right? Is dealing with things like that. So maybe I have a dream that someday our streets department will be the people who field those complaints and not the alder person.
I agree. And I think that some of the reason that, you know, we have four one ways in a row that all go the same direction and dead end into other one ways.
And these are kind of the internal residential streets in Tower Grove South.
Right. Yeah. And it doesn't make sense, but it's largely because we haven't had, you know, strategic planning around around our streets. And so, you know, I got in and I said, well, do we have data? Do we have information about traffic counts or speeds or any of these things? Because I don't want to go and, you know, make a street a one way or put in a stop sign without really understanding what that means. Is that going to cause another problem a block over? And what I found is we didn't have any information. The last time we had done traffic counts was, I think, 12 years previously. And in that time, we had changed almost every single artery around the ward, which, you know, changed cut-through
traffic.
Right,
so South Grand had a what we call a road diet, right? Went from four lanes to two. Arsenal went down to two lanes.
And Gravois, where the viaduct is, had a lane diet as well. But we had no information about that. And even when the planning went into those phases, we didn't have information about how that could impact the interior of the ward.
And so infrastructure has changed, but as we touched on earlier, the population has changed. And we're at a point where, you know, the car ownership was going up and up and up for decades because, you know, statistics show women were joining the workforce. And so you had two people driving to work every day instead of one back, you know, going way back to the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s. And then you had kids driving, and that's changed a little bit, but that growth hasn't happened. So you drop 2,000 residents in the neighborhood, and the number one complaint is still traffic,
right?
And which will always be. You could have, yeah, it could continue in that direction.
And we've also seen a lot more kids, and I think that plays into it as
that's
well.
That's interesting,
you know,
yeah. I did have a friend say they didn't want to move to Tower Grove because there were too many strollers, so which is something like, that's a new complaint, right?
That we is a new complaint.
You didn't hear that 10 years ago. He called it Strollerville.
So. Right. So, you know, basically I went to the streets department and I said, you know, I have residents who want a stop sign here, who don't want a stop sign here, and, you know, mm-hmm. we need some information. And the city actually doesn't have a traffic planning department. We had to outsource this to CBB to actually come in and do all the traffic counts and do all the speed checks and put together this this plan for us. But, you know, we had CBB and the streets department and MoDOT come out and do some information gathering sessions with the neighborhood. We had put a survey out there, figure out, you know, what are your chief complaints? And, you know, as we look at the variety of speed reduction things that we can use, whether it's speed bumps or speed tables or bump outs, what are the things that you're comfortable with? Mm-hmm. And so we got a feeling on that. And then they came back and basically gave us, you know, a huge 180-page document with everything, right. But then, you know, a 4-pager as well that...
And we'll get that at least posted online. I do want to write about it, but if not, at least it'll be on our website. It's probably on your website as well, right? And what is your website?
You want to get that it's MeganAaliyahGreen.com.
There you go. And you can find that on NextSTL.com as well. So that'll be interesting because it's, you know, on one hand, we have lots of information. You know what works in terms of traffic, but you do have to get the base information that pertains to your neighborhood. But then it just comes down to the politics, right?
Right.
Like what you're willing to support, what neighborhood, you know, what neighbors are going to be upset about and what they'll try and see what works.
And it has to be funded through our ward capital budget, too. So, you know, you have funding constraints, too. One of the things that people in the ward very much want to happen is that lane diet on South Grand to continue down to Gravois, if not Merrimack. And so we have some uniformity there. Mm-hmm. But that's almost a $2 million project. And so that's not something we can pay for.
And you only
for.
Have like $7 million in your ward funds, right? So you don't want to spend all of that
$300,000.
Yeah. No, I know. It's very modest and it gets split up so many ways. And so, yeah, I know a lot of wards pave alleys with that. Or they just take on small projects and it's hard to get big things done. But the other thing that's interesting, I think, that people may, you know, we think about or concentrate on some of the lack of capacity in St. Louis. So you said you had to outsource traffic counts and things like that. But what's interesting is it seems like once, if you can get a plan halfway down the road, no pun intended, the city will allow a lot of things to happen. So, and I remember speaking with Todd Welterman, who is the director of the city streets department at the time that it was proposed to reduce South Grand. And he flat out said, this is the dumbest idea I've ever heard of. Like, there's no way it's going to work. But you know what? The business association put together some money and we're just going to try it. And they set up a trial and they put up a big orange flashing sign that said, here's a phone number, call to complain, basically is what it said. Give us your input. And I saw that and thought, oh my God, this is set up to fail. And by his count, they had about 50-50 positive and negative.
Right.
But they looked at it and thought, well, the negatives are because it was a temporary setup, the lanes weren't lined up right and stuff like that. And so he kind of thought, well, in the end, we can do this. And basically, the city's not paying for it.
Right.
It was maybe the key, as they found a grant and that kind of thing. So it's actually the positive side of that is this is a pretty permissible city. So if you can bring an idea and you bring money, of course, they'll let you do a lot of different things. So we'll follow that and see what else can be done. I mean, with a new traffic plan and with access to Tower Grove Park, there's, you know, that's going to change the neighborhood quite a bit. So
it will.
Very cool.
It will.
Well, let's get on to citywide issues.
Okay.
So things you've gotten involved in, a lot of aldermen just choose not to, I think. Like if you watch debates about the NFL stadium or about NGA or about Metrolink or something, most of them are just absent, you know? And I don't know whether their vote's already predetermined or they don't care or it doesn't go through their ward, so they don't do anything. Well, let's go back to the NFL, and eventually we'll stop talking about the NFL in St. Louis, I think. Hopefully they don't come back. So we went through this process that was, we don't need to rehash all of it, but it was a rush job at the end, basically, like a lot of things. And we went through, and it was, I don't know what it was, $200 million, $300 million, just people made up numbers, and everyone was supposed to say great. So how did you view your role in that debate, and how were you addressed as an alderperson? I mean, people expected your vote, right? They kind of came to you and said, you have to vote for this because it's so important to the city.
Right.
But how did that take place? Like, how do you as a representative of a ward learn about that? And then how are you addressed and how are you asked to consider the issue?
So I'm a person who does a lot of research. Like I recognize that I don't know everything, but I take the time to get to know it. So when months before, you know, we actually had agreement in front of us, I knew it was coming down the pipeline. I just started pulling up some information online, looking at some of the studies that were out there, and very quickly it showed that the research that's out there is overwhelmingly says that public subsidies of sports stadiums is a bad return on investment for cities. It's not just that there's no return on investment. It actually hurts cities.
There's a consensus basically. I don't know if it's quite approaching global warming consensus, but it's,
but there's a consensus.
Yeah, it's pretty overwhelming.
Only quote unquote studies that say it's a good idea are the ones that are commissioned by the NFL or chambers of commerce or people who have, you know, a personal stake or a personal financial interest in having a team here.
Right. And so I do remember that you put together a reading list basically, right?
Right.
That were 20 studies, 30 studies. I don't know. It was everything you could
together. I categorized it, and then I put out after I read through everything, I put together another blog post that, you know, gave links to everything and kind of synthesized it and said, you know, these are the lessons we need to learn from other cities. This, you know, if we're not learning it from ourselves, I mean, we made a pretty bad deal.
Yes. It's very tempting to look at other cities and whether that's transportation or other things, but we could just learn a lot by looking at what we've done, right?
So seeing that and saying, you know, this doesn't make sense. And then myself and an older woman in Gracia, she's very much kind of cut from that same cloth, likes to have information before making decisions.
Yeah. You make it sound so novel. Like we're kind of different than the other aldermen. We like to be informed. You know, you didn't say it that way. I said it that way.
Not exactly. but we noticed that, you know, there were a couple of national experts that really stood out on this. So we just started calling them and sending them emails and saying, hey, we're doing this in St. Louis. We'd appreciate if you would be able to look at the agreement here and give us some feedback on it. Mm-hmm. And through those conference calls, those conversations, you know, we learned a lot that, you know, that there were things that we needed to look at in this agreement. And there were things that in that agreement that were people who are experts in sports financing had never seen before. So they had never seen a deal where first it was 60% and then 100% of, you know, game day tax revenues going back to the team. Mm-hmm. They said, well, then what is the incentive to do this at all?
Right.
You're not getting any tax revenue from it. And so they basically what we got from those conversations was it's a bad deal to begin with, you know, just in the premise of publicly funded stadiums.
This is worse.
This is an exceptionally bad deal. This is probably the worst deal that we have ever seen.
What was the best argument you heard in favor of the stadium?
I mean, the civic pride argument, you know, and I think in my mind that was the only argument that was really going in the stadium's favors. Can you put a price on civic pride? Mm-hmm. And I guess what I turn it around and I think, well, there are a lot of things for us to be proud about in St. Louis, and I don't think we're always as proud of them as we should be. We're notoriously hard on ourselves here.
Right.
And I don't think that a football stadium is one of those. When you look at the reasons people move here, they're not saying, oh, it's because they have, you know, a football stadium. They're moving here because it's affordable. There's a good work, there's jobs available, or there's, you know, it's walkable or access to public transit, or there's good universities. It's, you know, football stadium is very far on that down on that list of the reasons people choose to locate to a city.
Well, and I always thought this should be really obvious, but you know, this would have been, the fourth professional sports stadium we were proposing for downtown in the course of like 25 years.
Right.
Let's at least think about how downtown has done in the last 25 years. It's done very, very poorly. I mean, just hemorrhaged jobs. You know, we've added residents with the warehouse conversions, but those warehouses were vacant for a reason. And so somehow we've built an arch and we've built four stadiums and we were trying to build a fifth, and it doesn't work for downtown.
Right.
Like, I don't know why that isn't painfully, painfully obvious. You know?
Well, sometimes I feel like, I want to call it, for lack of a better term, bright, shiny object syndrome, mm-hmm. Where we're very attached to these big projects and that this is going to transform downtown, but we don't necessarily look at the type of projects. So, mm-hmm. One of the things when I was talking with the experts on sports financing, they said to me, you want to put a stadium on your least valuable piece of property,
right.
because the only thing that is a worse investment than a football stadium is a cemetery. And so
we have a few of those too. Are you suggesting that
but we wouldn't put a cemetery on the riverfront,
right?
Well,
it probably is a cemetery.
Well, there is,
yeah,
there's some Native American burial grounds there, but intentionally now we wouldn't say this is where we're going to put our cemetery.
Well, and that was always the duplicity of the argument for the stadium was, A, this is prime land. This is like the most valuable land. Let's dump a stadium there. And then on the other hand, it was like, well, nothing else is going to be built here unless we build a stadium. It's
right.
Like, well, what the?
Which neglected also that there was a whole plan in place from Great Rivers Greenway that had been put out, almost a year previously.
Yeah.
And
investments that are happening there. I mean, it's a big area, but you have Bissinger's Chocolate that just moved there, and they moved there before there was any concept of there being a stadium or anything happening there, right? And you have other active businesses in the area that were talked about at the time. So, but leading into big projects, let's talk about Paul McKee and Northside, mm-hmm. And also the NGA. So neither one are in your ward. Why do you care what happens?
Oh, because these huge developments like this, they have a citywide impact. So
the city's paying, your ward's paying for it, right? Your
we're
residents are subsidizing it or paying for
we're
it.
We're all paying for it.
Sure.
And I think, it also speaks to when you make a precedent to do something like what we're doing in North City, when you make the precedent that you're going to mortgage city properties to mm-hmm. Put that money towards something that is not improving those properties, that is a completely separate project, that's a very dangerous precedent to set for the city. Mm-hmm. And that impacts people in every single ward when we choose to make a decision like that. And so I do think it's important that we're looking, we're getting out of being so fragmented and we're taking a more, citywide and regional look at how our policies play off of each other.
And so right now, regionally, we're fighting with St. Clair County, Illinois over this, right? And I think they've each lined up, St. Clair County and Illinois, and then St. Louis City and Missouri have each lined up about $130 million worth of incentives to try mm-hmm. to lure this agency here. That's not regionalism.
No.
That's craziness.
It is.
Is the city stuck? Like, is their city, what's the choice for the city at that point, though? It seems like they should be trying to keep the NGA, correct?
Right. I mean, it's this catch-22. Mm-hmm. we want to keep NGA, but we also have to ask at what cost. Mm-hmm. So, when we put this deal together, one of the things we did was expand the Northside Regeneration TIF area. Mm-hmm. And so even if this is built in North City, we're only going to receive about half of the earnings tax revenue that we currently get. And we have to remember it's a government mm-hmm. organization. It's not paying property taxes. And so the money that we get from NGA really is that earnings tax money. So if that money is going back into the TIF instead of to the city, we're already mm-hmm. in a losing proposition.
And if the earnings tax goes away at some point, then we're literally at zero in terms of revenue from the NGA. So
but one of the, the challenges is, at the board, we don't have a financial analyst that works at the board. We don't get fiscal notes with the things that we pass. During NGA, I literally remember Scott Ogilvy there on the floor getting a calculator out, trying to, figure out the actual financial implications of this.
That's a crazy way to run a city.
It is. And when I went down there, it was one of the things that surprised me most, because I thought just all cities had fiscal notes, that was just standard.
Right. They should provide you as a representative with some kind of information with which to make a decision, right?
Right.
And they don't. They send you a bill and tell you we got to vote on it tomorrow.
And so then it's really up to us to take the initiative to find experts in bonding or find experts in financing that'll give us a different opinion from, SLDC or the mayor's office or whoever who does want to see this happen. And you want to make sure that those numbers are the same no matter who was looking mm-hmm. at it.
And so I think that the work that you're doing, the work that Scott's doing, the work that Christine and a couple other aldermen are doing is supported by your residents. I mean, you were voted into office. I think my perception is that you're supported by your residents. And still, that's not... the added questions and taking a calculator out and wanting to know real numbers hasn't really been welcomed necessarily by bill sponsors for the NFL stadium or the MGA. I'm trying to find a question there.
I mean, I think it's a culture change.
Why?
It's a culture change. And, you know, anytime you add new people into the mix who maybe have a different way of operating or a different viewpoint, it always makes for, you know, turmoil for a while until, you know, people
until
figure
you guys
out,
take over and then you're in charge and then it's great.
I don't know about that. But, but I mean, yeah. I think eventually, you know, there's stuff that we learn from people who have been there for 20 years.
And
there are good people there that people can learn from us too, as bringing a different perspective to the table.
So along this process, what people have seen is that there are people on the Board of Aldermen who are very, I don't know, proud of the Board of Aldermen, who take exception to any criticism of the Board of Aldermen. And you kind of stepped on that with a tweet where you maybe I'll let you phrase it. But it was surrounding the NFL and basically stating that the, I don't know, the backdoor deals and maybe even use the word bribery. I should have the tweet in front of me. But what it strikes me funny is, like, that's one tweet, you know?
Right.
It's like, and I understand you're an alderwoman, you're a colleague,
right,
but my God, I bet there's 1,000 tweets a day saying the Board of Aldermen is corrupt.
Right.
And like, and this idea that you're going to take exception to someone
and there's
noting
been
that is
tweets
kind of crazy.
Sent by other older people who say that same thing.
So why, and, so why did this happen? Why did you become a target of colleagues, and why were they that upset about it?
I mean, I'm still trying to understand that to a certain extent. I didn't know at the time. It wasn't until people brought it to my attention later that, you know, nearly the exact same thing had been said by, you know, three different men over the last 4 years.
Right.
And so is it all because I'm a woman? I don't know. Is it because I'm, you know, willing to challenge the system, ask some very critical questions, point out flaws in our operating, which I think we should be doing. And
absolutely.
I think that any form of government, we have a responsibility to say that we can always be operating better and look at ways that that we can perform better. And I hope that as being somebody who's new to the system, I still have, you know, my eyes open to a point where I can say, you know, I'm not in that this is just the way that everything has always been done mentality, because I haven't been there that long. But there will come a point in time when I no longer...
You're not the new person.
I'm not the
anymore.
New person. I don't have that fresh set of eyes.
And you'll be defending the Board of Aldermen.
Exactly.
That'll
exactly.
Be fun. I can't wait for that. No, but it struck me, the whole thing struck me, and then the conversation about, you know, misogyny on the board is just strikes me as like, yeah, of course. Like, I feel like any of my friends, any of my colleagues would be like, yeah, there's corruption there. Like, is it stuff that people are going to be thrown in jail for? Is it millions and millions of dollars? Probably not. But I mean, just as a fact of life, I mean, there's corruption in school systems. There's corruptions in corporations. There's corruption in Congress. Why would we think that 28 aldermen, some of whom have been in office for decades, would not have any corruption at all? Mm-hmm. And that when you come along a deal that's hundreds of millions of dollars and you understand the money involved, that there wouldn't be some... I mean, I'll call it corruption because I don't, I'm not responsible for, to my colleagues on the Board of Aldermen, but, there's all kinds of deals that are done that I think are gross and verging on corrupt and maybe verging on illegal. And so it just struck me as like, why is anyone upset about this? And then saying that, you know, the Board of Aldermen, there's misogyny in the Board of Aldermen is again, like, no kidding. Like, I think, you know, everyone listening to this probably has seen that at their workplace at some point. You've seen it in college. You've seen it on the street. It just exists. Like, so it's just, I kind of looked at it. I didn't even like, I think I, you know, responded on social media, but it was just like, are you kidding? Like, are you upset about this? And I guess it comes down to it was a colleague. It was one of their own or one of your own kind of pointing these things out. So where does that stand? I know you have, you know, allies and not allies on the Board of Aldermen, but where do your relationships stand with your colleagues?
I mean, it's tough to say, you know, some alders, I think, you know, it's going to be difficult to, even before this, to have a good relationship, just because we come at our role and responsibility as aldermen from a very different place.
Yeah.
But I also think that, you know, at some point in time, you almost have to have a breakdown before you can move forward. You have to hit rock bottom before mm-hmm. you can coalesce around something and improve your operating and move forward. And so, you know, I'm hoping from this that that we can get to a place to have some real conversations about transparency in government, some real conversations about ethics and campaign finance. And I mean, our rules are more lax than Jeff City at this point in time. And
yeah. And for people that don't know, the rules in Jeff City are virtually non-existent.
Right. Yeah. And so, you know, just in forms of, you know, even if everything always is on the up and up at City Hall, it's just the perception.
Mm-hmm.
And needing to have certain rules and procedures and standard operating, you know, protocols in place to mm-hmm. say, you know, maybe it's not okay that we allow lobbyists to sit on the floor of the board. Right now they're allowed to sit there as long as they're introduced. But maybe we need more of a delineation between you know, older people and people who are there to lobby the board, mm-hmm. if for no other reason than for public transparency.
Sure. Okay. Well, we're talking about the Board of Aldermen, and they're, let's see, several years from now, it's 2016, I think 2013 maybe is the first year the number of wards will be reduced, right? So it's following the 2020 census, which comes out
right.
in 2021, and the next election is 2013. So the city's going from 28 wards to 14.
Correct.
Have you thought ahead in what how that impacts you personally and whether you'll run for a seat and what you do?
I mean, I'm definitely planning on running. Mm-hmm. What I would say is I would really like us to look at a more democratic process for how those ward boundaries are drawn. So,
right.
you know, we now have Supreme Court precedent that upheld what they did in drawing their, you know, redistricting in Arizona that basically allowed a nonpartisan community commission to mm-hmm. to draw those boundaries.
I think it's in California, and there's a nonpartisan judges draw the boundaries, I think.
Correct.
Yeah, so currently the wards are look weird.
Yes.
And it's I understand it, to include the homes of certain individuals so that their ward doesn't change because they've lived there for 40 years
right.
and they're involved in politics and stuff like that. So it would be great to see that change. And there'll be a big fight over it, for sure.
There will. And so I hope that the more that we can take aldermen out of it and mm-hmm. give it to a community commission or a group that at least goes throughout
right.
the city and says, you know, what are the expectations that citizens have for this? I mean, we have some aldermen who represent parts of 10 neighborhoods.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's 10 neighborhood meetings on a monthly basis, perhaps 10 business organization meetings on yeah. a monthly basis. And not to mention that some neighborhoods are divided between four or five aldermen, and it's they don't know who represents them.
Right. And our commercial districts are the same way. That's one of the things that, that we've written about on the site is making sure that, you know, it doesn't make sense for Gravois to have to each, you know, to different sides of the street to be a different ward, because
right.
then you don't have an older person in charge of a commercial district or,
right.
you know, understanding how tax revenue adjusts, you know, based on different policies for a commercial district and things like that. And so you don't have a downtown
right.
for your ward, and that creates its own problems. So it sounds like it's a positive thing in your mind that we're going from 28 to 14.
It is. I mean, theoretically, yes. My concern mm-hmm. About it is that we already have a number of under-resourced wards, particularly in North City.
Mm-hmm.
And we have wards that are two, three, four times as large as the ward that I represent. And we get the exact...
In terms of land size. So they're redistricted
size.
Based on... They try to get them the same number of residents. So you're about 11,000 residents per ward currently. So,
correct.
But yeah, but you're right. The irony is that the more residents leave, the bigger the ward gets.
Correct.
Right?
But then every ward gets the exact same amount of ward capital
right.
money. So you might have four times as many streets to pave or dumpsters to replace or lights to replace. And so how do you ever, you know, for one of those wards,
right.
how do you ever get ahead? How do
yeah.
you ever get real infrastructure
yeah.
investment
mm-hmm.
in there? And so I think that needs to be taken into consideration. I think the other thing, you know, I hope that when we consolidate, we're not looking at cutting funding from the board.
Mm-hmm.
What we need to be doing is adding staff. We need, you know, a legislative researcher. We need a financial analyst. We need, you know, somebody that can focus
right.
on constituent service issues, you know, all of the CSB type complaint systems. And that's very standard for other cities. cities, even of our size, is right. for every alder person to have at least one person that's dedicated to them for constituent service and for legislative research. Mm-hmm. And we need to be looking at how do we build the capacity of the board so that we're we can act as a good constituent mm-hmm. service and policy-making body.
Yeah, and I think if nothing else, one thing I've been meaning to do, and I haven't gotten to it, add to the list of things that I would like to write about is just how often current aldermen are recognized in the news or written about, or you know, is there anyone watching them? And when you have 28, right. I would imagine there are a number of them who simply do not appear in the Post-Dispatch or the St. Louis American in an entire year, right? And so there's kind of no one in terms of thinking as a journalist or the press even paying attention to what they do. And it's the same problem in St. Mm-hmm. Louis County is like, right. you know, no one's covering 90 different mayors or municipalities. Right. So that, if nothing else, that helps. So there are 14 aldermen. So you can kind of get an idea of like, oh, those are the 14 people in charge of our city. And it's just hard to conceptualize 28 and understand how that functions. So we'll see what happens. Yeah. to be determined on whether that's in the end, it works out well or not. So the last thing I wanted to hit on, I think we touched on NGA. Is there anything else you want to add about that? Because there are issues of eminent domain. We talked about right. the financing.
I mean, I went up there, I guess, a little over a week ago. Mm-hmm. We have some folks who are fasting up there, waiting for this decision because it keeps getting pushed back. And one of the things that struck me the most about being up there is, you know, they took me around and they said, they basically showed me the number of houses that had been single family owner occupied. And then McKee comes in or one of his shell companies mm-hmm. and offers to buy them out.
Right.
They sell, nothing happens to it, the property depreciates, so mm-hmm. then a different shell company goes to the neighbor who is sick and tired of living yeah. next to a house that's falling down and buys them out.
And tells them, hurry, because your home, the price will be less next month and right. next month and next month.
And,
right.
and so, you know, it really showed a very, you know, strategic and orchestrated effort to create disinvestment in that area. And
this has been going on for a decade with city support.
More than a decade.
And with the support of aldermen in that area.
Right.
How does that happen?
Well, I think in the beginning, it's hard to say how it all started. I like to give people the benefit of the doubt and think that maybe when McKee first started buying those properties and because there were so many different LLCs that were mm-hmm. coming in and buying them up that maybe nobody realized what was happening until it was too late. I mean, anybody mm-hmm. can buy a property from somebody.
Right, and this is part of the argument, is that you and I could have walked up there and bought a property for $1,100.
Right.
And no one did. For a long time, no one mm-hmm. did. And so he was the first to start that, I guess, in a big way. So,
but, I still think, you know, we need to learn some lessons from mm-hmm. this. And, I mean, if for no other reason that there are people who wanted to stay there, and mm-hmm. But when suddenly you're living next to a house that's, you know, falling down, that had been, you know, it wasn't the nicest house, but it was kept up, and suddenly it becomes a place that people are breaking into on a regular basis because it's sitting vacant. I mean, it changes the whole fabric of a neighborhood. The other thing that really was eye-opening for me is they brought me out this binder, thick binder, of a neighborhood plan that they had created back in 1990, mm-hmm. That the residents had gotten together. They had contracted with an urban planning company to help and say, you know, these are the things that we want in our neighborhood, and this is how we get there. And they created this 30-year plan, and it was quite, you know, miraculous to go through it. But what was so heartbreaking about it is if they had ever been able to get buy-in in that plan, it would be being completed in 2020.
Right.
And so how different would that area be now if, mm-hmm. you know, that resident-led planning that had happened in 1990 was actually, mm-hmm. you know, something that we had taken a hold of and carried through.
Well, I think that highlights a real negative in the way the city addresses some of the big planning ideas, because going all the way back, once what Paul McKee was doing was understood, and then there was the $300-something million TIF, you know, right. almost $400 million, as an individual, you would be crazy, in my opinion, to buy anything adjacent to it, in it. And he owned 1,000 properties. The city sold him another 1,000. But there were like 8,000 more properties within his redevelopment district that were privately owned.
Right.
And as an investor or as a resident, I would think, like, clearly I have no impact on what happens next to me, down the mm-hmm. street, a half mile away. Like,
right.
someone else has some huge vision which may or may not happen. And I was a resident here of the 17th Ward in Forest Park Southeast for a number of years. And you felt a little bit of that here. I mean, you have some big players that, you know, when I bought my house, there were all these beautiful renderings. And we went through a financial crisis, which, you know, right. nothing people can do about that. But you start to realize that what happens in the neighborhood and in parts of the neighborhood are just out of your hands.
Right.
There are institutions or the city that has some big idea. And if it takes them 5 years to do it, great. If it takes them 25 years, great. And in the meantime, every single day you're living next to vacant lots and next right. to broken sidewalks and things like that. So those things create a real disincentive for any kind of other investment, because it's just, you have no, rightfully, you would have no confidence that your investment's going to pay off
right.
or that you're, you know, you control the future of it. So we'll see. We're a couple days away from the announcement of NGA, and this will post after we learn that decision. So maybe we'll have you back and talk about what that means for that part of the city. The last thing I wanted to hit on is not only do you have a vision for your ward in the city, but you're involved in national politics. So mm-hmm. I gather from your social media that you're a big Bernie supporter.
I am a very big Bernie supporter.
Yeah.
Yes.
So what are you doing and on the local level for that campaign, and mm-hmm. where does that campaign stand, and how do you see that playing out?
You know, basically, I got very involved with St. Louis for Bernie, which was basically a grassroots group of folks that were hoping that Bernie would eventually open an office mm-hmm. here.
And this goes way back before it was, you really knew how much traction he had and
right.
whether he would make it to the Missouri primary.
This was last August when people started getting organized around this and doing some fundraisers and doing, you know, some outreach around it. Bernie Sanders is somebody that I had followed for a number of years because I think that his politics are very much in line with mine. I mean, I think that we need to get money out of politics. I'm tired of all of these special interests being, you know, having such a strong hand in the political mm-hmm. system all the time. I'm tired of us as a country continuing to, you know, find money for, you know, war or corporate handouts or whatever, but we can't ever find money to address poverty and addiction and education and those bread and butter issues that really do impact people's lives. And I felt like the Democratic Party has gotten very far away from kind of its New Deal or Great Society roots, and Bernie Sanders kind of represents being able to go back to being that party of big ideas and government spending and investing in people, and so I'd been really drawn to him and become kind of a local surrogate, just talking at a lot of fundraisers, office grand openings, things like that, and then because of that involvement, when he came to town, I was able to be one of the introductory speakers, which was quite an amazing,
cool.
quite an amazing effort there.
So where does it go from here? You want to make it a prediction? Do you have a feeling for how the campaign's going?
You know, we have a lot of momentum right now, which is good. Mm-hmm. We have to see how Wisconsin goes. I'm originally from upstate New York, and it seems like a lot of the people that at least I know back there are very much involved on the Bernie wagon. So I'm hoping that that ends up translating to a win. We have some really big states ahead of us. So if we can, you know, win New York, if we can win California, if hopefully we can win Pennsylvania, yeah. And by a large enough margin, I mean, we're only a little over 200, you know, pledged delegates behind right now. So mm-hmm. there's still a lot of
there's a lot of hope there.
There is.
So and then the question of the day is if Hillary Clinton becomes the Democratic Party nominee, do you vote for her? Do you support the party?
More than likely, I will vote for her. And absent of, you know, my dream scenario mm-hmm. would be that the Republican Party splits with, you know,
so because, and so and so and so. I don't even want to
right.
talk about that.
And so then that provides an opportunity for, you know, a split within the Democratic Party
right.
as
so,
well.
So Bernie wins the presidency with 28% of the vote.
Right. I mean, I think we need a multi-party system.
I still have my Ross Perot shirt from 1992. So you never know. I mean, Clinton, you know, Bill Clinton won with significantly less than 50% of the vote,
right.
if I remember. So, all right. Well, with that, I think we'll leave it. And thanks for joining us. Really appreciate
it. Not a problem. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
This has been the Future Great City Podcast on nextstl.com. Thanks for joining us. Be informed. Be engaged. be part of what's next. NextSTL.com.